This talk was part of Marxism 2010, A Planet to Save, A World to Win. The conference took place on May 28th through 30th at the Ryerson University Student Center. For more information, please visit www.marxismconference.ca.
All right, thanks everyone for coming to hear Jesse McLaren speak on floods, famines, and earthquakes, the rise of disaster capitalism. Jesse's going to speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions and contributions after. Jesse.
Great. So we certainly seem to be living in an era of natural disasters. In 2003, a heat wave hit Europe. In 2004, a tsunami smashed into South Asia. In 2005, a hurricane leveled New Orleans. From 2007 to 2008, a food crisis gripped much of the world. And in just the first 5 months of 2010, we've had earthquakes shaking Haiti, Chile, and China, a volcano in Iceland showering Western Europe in ash, and there's just been new warnings of the worst hurricane season since 2005 coming up, which of course is going to take all the oil that's now in the Gulf and going to throw it up in the air and on the ground and all around. And seeing these as purely natural disasters, as they're often called, have generated, I think, a big amount of fear of nature. We've seen, if anybody's seen the movie 2012, basically shows that the Earth is almost personified as this angry, violent planet that's annihilating humanity, that's chasing the main characters all around the world. And the term natural disaster itself, I think, gives the impression that nature and society are these two distinct and separate entities, and that occasionally nature, for whatever reason, lashes out and attacks humanity. But increasingly, natural disasters are neither purely natural, nor are they inevitable disasters. While society doesn't create earthquakes or volcanoes, it is increasingly driving hurricanes and heat waves, and it determines whether drought becomes famine. And regardless of how events occur, it's society that determines whether or not they truly become disasters. If you take two examples, the largest tsunami on record was half a kilometer high, and it struck Alaska in 1958, but it sank one boat and killed two people. On the other hand, a much smaller tsunami in 2004 killed a quarter of a million people in South Asia. If you put a 7.0 earthquake in San Francisco in 1989, 50,000 people crammed into a baseball stadium hardly notice it. Put the same 7.0 earthquake off the coast of Port-au-Prince, and you have massive destruction. So it's not nature on its own that produces natural disasters, but nature's interaction with society. And this is the idea behind Frederick Engels' book, The Dialectics of Nature, which outlined a Marxist approach to ecology, seeing humanity and nature as interdependent, each reacting on the other. As he argued, the naturalistic conception of history, as if nature exclusively reacts on people, and natural conditions everywhere exclusively determine their historical development, is one-sided and forgets that people also react on nature, changing it and creating new conditions of existence for themselves. The Earth's surface, climate, vegetation, fauna, and the human beings themselves have infinitely changed, and all this owing to human activity. So human activity, the way society is organized, the way production is organized, the priorities of society, that determines the impact that we have on nature and the impact that nature has on us. And this mutual interaction has changed through history. As society's productive capacities have developed, people's relationship with nature and with each other has changed over time, and this has shaped the causes and the consequences of so-called natural disasters. In pre-capitalist societies, people didn't have the resources or the technology to protect themselves from natural events. So the deadliest earthquake on record was in China in 1556, and it killed 830,000 people, because at the time, people lived in caves that were carved into the sides of hills, so those collapsed or were buried under landslides. Occasionally, these early societies did undermine the Earth and their own survival. So the famous society on Easter Island or the Mayan Empire, their rulers built more and more temples or statues and in the process cut down all the trees. And the deforestation and erosion undermined all the life on which society was built and led to collapse. But these pre-capitalist disasters were local and were limited by an economy based on stone tools. I'm going to focus on disasters under capitalism, both in the 19th and early 20th century, and also capitalism of today. So capitalism greatly changed the way that humans interacted with nature and with each other. It drove, and it continues to drive, people off the land, separating them from nature and from a direct control over their livelihoods, and concentrates them in cities as wage laborers to produce commodities. And this goal was actually often very consciously articulated by right-wing economists of the day. So if you look at Thomas Malthus, who's famous for his theories of overpopulation, this was actually very much linked to his desire to exploit both the earth and people. He argued in the 1830s or 40s that the land in Ireland is infinitely more populous than in England, and to give full effect to the natural resources of the country, a great part of the population should be swept from the soil into large manufacturing and commercial towns. And shortly afterwards, the Irish potato famine provided early capitalism with the disaster that accomplished exactly this goal. It's been blamed on the potato blight, which is a disease that destroys potatoes. But the blight actually swept across the whole continent of Europe, and it was only in Ireland that it produced famine. And as the Irish saying went, God gave us the potato blight, but the English gave us the famine. So Britain had impoverished the land by stealing the resources. The landlords had concentrated people on these tiny plots of land to maximize the amount of rent they could get. And as a result, people turned to the potato for subsistence because it was the easiest thing to grow in large quantities. So when the blight came along, it destroyed the one food upon which people had been made dependent. But even that didn't guarantee famine. There was huge supplies of wheat, which Britain guarded at gunpoint and continued to export at the height of the famine. While wealthy Irish landlords evicted people who couldn't pay the rent. People did fight back. There was food riots. There was armed resistance to evictions. But by the end, the famine had killed 1 million people out of a total of around 6, and another 1 million had emigrated, mainly to major cities to work as laborers. Through the development of industry and the concentration of the population, capitalism developed a huge productive forces. But because it's in the hands of private firms in competition with one another, production is not devoted towards human need, but to capital accumulation. Firms are driven to accumulate and to invest in order to beat their rivals. And this gives capitalism a relentless drive to expand. As Marx argued, the bourgeoisie during its rule of scarce 100 years has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than all the preceding generations put together. Fanatically bent on making value expand itself, the capitalist ruthlessly forces the human race to produce for production's sake. Accumulation for the sake of accumulation, production for production's sake. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, and establish connections everywhere. And the cruel irony in Ireland of having people starve in the midst of plenty is not an accident, but is actually a central feature of capitalism. Because it's based on the unplanned drive to accumulate and of firms competing with one another, capitalism inevitably produces a series of crises of overproduction, which is a bit of a ridiculous term. But basically when production outstrips consumption and the economy is thrown into crisis. And when it's faced with that solution, or with that problem, capitalism's solution is actually to destroy a large part of the economy and to increase the exploitation of others. As Marx explained, society suddenly finds itself put back into a state of momentary barbarism. It appears as if a famine, a universal war of devastation, had cut off the supply of every means of subsistence. Industry and commerce seem to be destroyed. And why? Because there's too much civilization, too much subsistence, too much industry, too much commerce. And how does the bourgeoisie get over these crises? On the one hand, by the enforced destruction of a mass of productive forces, and on the other hand, by the conquest of new markets and by the more thorough exploitation of the old ones. That is to say, by paving the way for more extensive and more destructive crises and by diminishing the means whereby crises are prevented. And this is what happened in the 1870s. There was a global recession that gripped the world, and because markets became saturated, and the solution was militarized investment abroad. The concentration of economic power had paralleled the concentration of political power around the state to defend it. And because economic competition is by its very nature international, it perpetually drives states beyond their borders in the conquest of new markets. And in the scramble for colonies, imperial powers took advantage of a series of El Nino events which happened around the same time, which had weakened societies that didn't have the productive capacity to actually withstand it. In his book, Late Victorian Holocaust, Mike Davis recounts how the imperialist powers made use of disasters to gain control of the world for their markets. He wrote, "In southern Africa, the Great Drought became the chief ally of Portuguese and British aggression against still independent African societies. The extension of the plantation system and the consolidation of colonial power in the Angolan interior were carefully synchronized to the sinister rhythm of drought and disease. Each global drought was a green light for an imperialist land rush. Yet the southern African drought of 1877 was Britain's opportunity to strike against Zulu independence. Then Ethiopian famine of 1889 was Italy's mandate to build a new Roman Empire in the Horn of Africa. Likewise, Germany exploited the floods and drought that devastated Shandong in the late 1890s to aggressively expand its sphere of influence in northern China, while the U.S. was simultaneously using drought, famine, and disease as weapons to crush the Philippines. The European empires, together with Japan and the U.S., rapaciously exploited the opportunity to wrest new colonies, expropriate communal lands, and tap novel sources of plantation and mine labor. The total human toll of these three waves of drought, famine, and disease could not have been less than 30 million victims." Now, the same drought and colonial oppression triggered widespread resistance, but at the end of the day, imperialism won, and the result is an impoverished global south that remains vulnerable to natural events. At the same time, in the global north, natural events became investment opportunities. In 1906, a 7.9 scale earthquake struck San Francisco, leaving half the residents homeless and killing 3,000 people. But at the time, the government actually only reported 300, intentionally minimizing the death toll to protect real estate prices and ignoring the deaths of the poor and densely populated Chinatown. Real estate interests had long wanted to displace Chinatown to take advantage of its prime real estate location, and developers jumped at the opportunity that the earthquake offered by leveling Chinatown. As one developer stated, "What men have failed to accomplish during the previous four decades, nature did in 3 days." But the community actually fought back against the ethnic cleansing plans and actually won, and Chinatown was rebuilt in its historical location. And another sort of silver lining of the event was that City Hall, that contained all the immigration records, was flattened. So as a result, Chinese Americans were able to claim citizenship and to bring over their families. Now, 100 years later, capitalism has become a global system with the resources and the technology beyond early society's wildest dreams, which should allow us to survive and to cope with and to sustain any sort of disaster. But the same productive capacity has been turned against us and against the planet, producing the nightmare of climate change. Though much more is known about how humanity and nature can coexist in harmony, capitalism is undermining nature and our ability to adapt to it. And I want to break this down to three broad features that are inherent to capitalism: the drive to accumulate, the role of the state, and the reliance on devastation. So first of all, accumulation. I think everybody can agree that capitalism remains fanatically bent on making value expand itself. And over time, this has developed to create a whole new set of disasters, from heat waves to volcanic vulnerabilities to a food crisis. For the system as a whole, the long-term impact of production for production's sake has created the disaster of global warming, which was on dramatic display in the summer of 2003 when a heat wave killed 35,000 people across Western Europe, half of whom were in France. There was a week where temperatures were above 40 degrees in the summer, and this will actually be the norm of every summer in 30 years if climate change has not changed. So that was an underlying cause, and then along came government policies to actually undermine detection and response. In France, the Tory government had been cutting millions out of healthcare and pensions against a wave of strikes and protests. And all of a sudden, we had firefighters, hospital staff, nursing home workers saying that there was a huge spike in the number of people dying from heat strokes, especially the elderly, creating a healthcare crisis and that they needed more resources. From their vacation in the Alps, the government denied the reports and refused to provide emergency funding, and then later actually blamed the crisis on workers and their 35-hour work week. Now, as capitalism has developed to create the colossal productive forces capable of global warming, these have been centered in larger and larger companies. Through the process of accumulation, capital becomes concentrated, and through periodic crises and mergers, it becomes centralized. And so now we actually have a situation where most markets are dominated by just a few massive corporations. There's the big three automakers, there's four major poultry producers, capitalist and pharmaceutical giants, a few airline companies, and a handful of agribusiness companies. And this development has created vulnerabilities to both volcanoes and famines. Just last month, Iceland's volcano erupted and spewed 150,000 tons of carbon dioxide per day, and the right-wing press was jubilant at the idea that the planet was actually hurting itself through through global warming. But this amount, 150,000 tons, is actually dwarfed by the daily production of emissions by the airline industry, day after day after day after day. Aviation is the fastest growing source of carbon emissions and is set to produce 15% of total emissions by 2050 by quadrupling the number of passengers in the process. And most of this increase is actually for short-haul flights that could be done by train. So in Britain, the most popular flight is actually from London to Manchester, which could easily be done by train. But because there's airline monopolies that have such huge, immense power because they're so concentrated and centralized, they have leverage over their governments. So while green public transit is underfunded, the unsustainable oil-driven airline industry gets so many billions of dollars each year that it actually makes it cheaper to take the most costly and the most polluting form of transportation. Now, the disaster, the volcano is clearly a disaster for corporate profits, but by grounding flights that actually save the planet from carbon emissions. And there's these sweet stories of people living near the airport who for the first time heard the sounds of birds. I think it was only a disaster for people, at least the vast majority of them who are actually traveling within Europe and don't need these cross-continental flights, because of the dominance of the airline industry and the lack of alternatives. The concentration and centralization of capital is actually making all the industries depend on oil, not just the airline industry or the oil companies, but also the food industry, which is a little bit ridiculous. And this combined with financial speculation has raised the haunting specter of actually having a 21st century famine. There's a great book by Vandana Shiva called Soil Not Oil, and it argues that the green revolution that was supposed to solve the problems of world hunger was neither green nor was it a revolution. Instead of empowering local communities to produce their own food, food has become concentrated into fewer and fewer corporate hands, which are increasingly reliant on oil for fertilizer, mechanization, and shipping. The dependence of corporate agriculture on oil actually leads to global warming, which further undermines food security. And at the same time, it has actually shackled the price of food to the price of oil, which is climbing as oil gets more and more difficult to obtain. The prices increase even further because of the opening up of the food market to speculation. So when the credit crunch hit, there was a huge panic in the financial and the property markets, and everybody surged towards what was seen as a stable source of profit, which was the agricultural commodities. So between 2007 and 2008, over around an 18-month period, the price of rice went up 320%, wheat went up 240%, and maize went up 280%. Food riots broke out around the world. In Egypt, the uprisings were part of a wave of protests against the Mubarak regime, while in Haiti, demonstrators kicked out Prime Minister Alexis. We've seen how the state, or how the concentrated economic power of corporations are producing disasters. At the same time, the concentrated political power of states are also producing and are interfering with disaster relief, both abroad and at home. As corporations have grown and expanded internationally, they've not eroded the power of the state, but actually become more dependent on it. They need subsidies to compete internationally. They need the state to break down trade barriers and tariffs. They rely on the state to invade and to occupy nations on their behalf. An earthquake in Haiti serves as the most brutal example, where the scale of devastation was not only because of what happened underground, but because of its interaction with what was happening on top of the ground. It was the same magnitude as the San Francisco quake of 1989, but it killed 4,000 times as many people. According to a seismologist writing in Nature magazine, earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do. And we are now seeing that buildings are in fact acting as weapons of mass destruction. It's completely unacceptable that we should live in a world where you can shake the ground a little bit and the buildings will fall down. But this unacceptable situation has been imposed on Haiti by state intervention, which not only undermined the buildings, but also the Earth's surface, climate, vegetation, and the human beings themselves. So it started off with France, with colonization, and with them imposing a huge, massive debt. The U.S. then used the debt to remove food tariffs, allowing the U.S. agribusinesses to swamp the country with rice. This destroyed agriculture, making Haiti dependent on imports and aid, and driving people into slums to work in sweatshops. Then, through multiple coups, the government imposed governments, through the U.S.-imposed governments that held down wages and privatized everything from publicly owned cement companies to electricity. So as a result, people have had to live in unsafe, self-made homes. And finally, the ground itself on which the homes are made is increasingly unstable because of the near total deforestation of Haiti. The deforestation began with the French, who stole lumber, and continued as farmers were pressured to grow cash crops, and others have been forced to search for fuel. With electricity privatized, charcoal is the main source of lighting, fuel, heat, and income. And so Haitians without jobs are actually forced to cut down their own trees to make charcoal to sell in order to buy rice that farmers no longer produce. The resulting deforestation produces soil erosion, which magnifies natural disasters, turning storms into mudslides, like in 2008, and earthquakes into landslides, like 2010. Finally, when the earthquake did hit, there was no public services available because they'd been cut or privatized, and instead a UN occupation force has taken over. So the long history of profit-driven foreign intervention has created a context ideal for earthquake catastrophe, turning a wealthy and a lush nation into an impoverished and deforested one, with a population concentrated in urban slums, living in inadequately built houses on eroded soil with no government services. Imperial powers then used the humanitarian catastrophe as an opportunity to further expand. So the U.S. sent troops to check their investments, Harper sent troops to check Canadian investments, and glorified the process to distract from the Afghan detainee scandal. He then used the militarization of aid as an argument for continuing the occupation of Afghanistan. The state also continues to protect profits at home, which has worsened earthquake response in Chile and China. When an earthquake hit Chile in February this year, the Social Democratic government was slow to provide food, water, and shelter. As one resident said, "People have gone days without eating. The only option is to come here and get stuff for ourselves." And when people began collecting food at a supermarket owned by Walmart, President Bachelet declared martial law, imposed a curfew, and sent in troops to use tear gas and water cannons to protect private property. But there was a large community mobilization which actually fought back and actually won the right to access the necessities of food and water shortly after the quake. The next month, an earthquake hit in western China, which was home in that region to both the oppressed Tibetan communities, but also home to the country's nuclear weapons. So when the earthquake hit, there was the government's first concern was unrest, private property, and also nuclear leaks. So they sent in 100,000 troops to secure banks, oil depots, and the nuclear reactors and testing sites. And they dispersed the Tibetan monks providing relief and delayed the arrival of international aid agencies. So we've seen how the state's priority of nuclear weapons over human needs has produced actually widespread collapse of homes and schools which were made of mud and wood. The need for a constantly expanding market not only pushes corporations and states to destroy the planet, but also to lay the foundation to see such events as market opportunities. And there was just watching an interview with Naomi Klein on The Real News, and she was saying that BP has actually been put in charge of the cleanup process in the Gulf. So the people whose lands and lives have been destroyed actually have to apply to the same company that has done the destruction in order to qualify for jobs to actually do the cleaning up. And this is not because I think of any sort of right-wing neoliberal ideology imposed on capitalism from without, but I think it's very much a consequence of capitalism's dependence on devastation in order to have opportunities for growth. After the Depression gripped much of the world, it was the Second World War that was actually required to bring capitalism out of crisis through a war economy and firebombed continents that need to be rebuilt. And both the tsunami and Hurricane Katrina show that for capitalism, these so-called natural disasters fulfill a similar role by destroying the mass productive forces and allowing the conquest of new markets and the more thorough exploitation of old ones. Now, the tsunami in 2004 was definitely natural. There's no way was it caused by society. But the fact that it was a disaster was completely unnatural. And we can see this by looking at Hawaii. And Hawaii is actually an example of what we can be doing in the future to actually prevent these things. So Hawaii has these waterfront parks that can be easily evacuated. It's set up forests to stop tsunamis. They had a whole bunch of tsunamis in the 50s and 60s, and they've redesigned the whole island to make it safe. They also have a tsunami warning center that can detect waves within 25 minutes, issue evacuation orders. And a result of all this use of resources and technology for the protection of people. Of course, in this case, it's for tourist money, but nonetheless, it shows what can be done. One tsunami specialist argued that there's no reason for a single individual to ever get killed in a tsunami. But South Asia, of course, has none of these features. Deforestation and coral reef destruction reduce natural defenses. Debt-burdened governments are unable to afford the tsunami detectors. And state repression has created vulnerable populations in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. As a result, a tsunami that shouldn't have killed a single individual and still instead killed 250,000. And it was followed by what was called a second tsunami of market opportunities. In the shock doctrine, Naomi Klein quotes from the Thailand tsunami survivors and supports a group of people fighting against this second tsunami. And they said that to businessmen, politicians, the tsunami was the answer to their prayers, since it literally wiped these coastal areas clean of the communities which had previously stood in the way of their plans for resorts, hotels, casinos, and shrimp farms. To them, all of these coastal areas are now open land. And we've seen a similar process the following year when Hurricane Katrina brought disaster capitalism home to the U.S. It again was neither purely natural nor was it an inevitable disaster. Global warming has increased the frequency of storms, and the destruction of the marshland deprived the Gulf Coast of natural protection. Meanwhile, human-made levees were left in a state of disrepair as billions were diverted to the military. Now, Katrina was actually the most predicted disaster in U.S. history, both because the previous year, Hurricane Ivan had raised the potential of a mass disaster. People knew what to expect and knew that more was coming. Secondly, there was actually computer simulation models that accurately showed what would happen that scientists actually spent millions of dollars developing. And there was also minute-by-minute meteorological tracking, seeing the hurricane gradually approaching day by day. And so, you know, completely predicted, and yet Bush did nothing. He defined himself as a climate change denier, and so he was ideologically driven to ignore all the warnings. It was also the best potential for disaster relief. There have been thousands of Americans signed up to the National Guard to provide disaster relief. There was an entire fleet of school buses that could have evacuated people. The French Quarter is the highest concentration of delicious food in the world, and that could have fed people. But the National Guard were in Iraq. The buses sat idle, and food was left to rot as thousands were crammed starving into the stadium. The anarchy of the market could not match up supply and demand, but it did seize upon the disaster to more thoroughly exploit the area. And the same corporate vultures in Iraq, Halliburton, Blackwater, Bechtel, came to New Orleans, while public school teachers and city workers were fired, public transit was privatized, and public housing was closed. As Republican Congressman Richard Baker said, echoing the San Francisco developers of 100 years previously, "We finally cleaned up housing, public housing, in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did." And the disaster also opened up these novel market opportunities. So Naomi Klein talks about this company called Kenyon, which is a mega funeral conglomerate, and they were paid millions to actually retrieve the dead bodies from the homes in the streets, something that developers and capitalism at the time of the previous disaster 100 years ago would never have dreamed of doing. But I think it's important in Katrina not to overstate the case of doom and gloom as much as there is. Because I think while the hurricane was an economic victory for Bush and his policies, it was an ideological defeat. The racism and the poverty of the world's most dominant power were in full view of the world. And there were attempts at the time by the Christian right to blame gays for the storm, by the media to blame blacks for looting, so-called looting. But these attempts, I think, by and large, completely failed. Because the anti-war movement had won people over. So instead of blaming each other, people blame climate change, racism, poverty, and war. I actually had a chance to see firsthand some of that experience. I was in North Carolina a month afterwards and took a bus up with a whole bunch of anti-war activists to D.C. to take part in the demonstration that you were speaking at. That had 500,000 people. And these connections were everywhere. I remember on the bus, people were distributing leaflets that compared the ethnic cleansing of New Orleans to that in Palestine. On the demo, there was placards everywhere saying, "Make levees not war," "No Iraqi left me on a roof to die," "From Baghdad to New Orleans, stop the war on the poor," and my favorite, "Bush had troops in the wrong Gulf." By seeing nature and humanity as interconnected, I think we can see the possibility of a world free from natural disasters if the labor that links us to nature is actually brought under democratic control. We have the food to avoid famines, the technology to detect tsunamis, the resources to protect ourselves from earthquakes and hurricanes, while creating a green economy that can save the planet. heading into the second decade of the 21st century, we've never been in a better position to know and to control our impact on nature and nature's impact on us. And yet human society increasingly devastates nature because it's based on private profit. And from the tar sands to the Gulf oil spill, there's a massive attack on nature. At the same time, so-called natural disasters increasingly lash out at society. But there's what I've tried to explain as well is that there's been a huge history of resistance to disaster capitalism, from the anti-colonial movements against famine to the communities resisting eviction from San Francisco in 1906 to New Orleans in 2005, from neighborhood committees demanding and distributing food and supplies in the wake of earthquakes in Haiti and Chile, as well as challenging the policies that lead to disasters or that seek to profit from them. We need to challenge the underlying system of capitalism that creates a rift between us and nature. Ultimately, restoring a healthy relationship with nature requires that we bring our ability to work collectively with nature under conscious democratic control. And I want to end with a rather alarm, but I think quite pertinent quote from Engels, who in The Dialectics of Nature 150 years ago wrote this in response to the natural disasters of his time. And I think it applies and is even more relevant to the disasters of our time. He said that at every step, we're reminded that we by no means rule over nature like a conqueror over a foreign people, like someone standing outside of nature, but that we, with flesh, blood, and brain, belong to nature and exist in its midst, and that all of our mastery consists in the fact that we have the advantage over all other creatures by being able to learn its laws and to apply them correctly. And with every day that passes, we are acquiring a better understanding of its laws and getting to perceive both the more immediate and the more remote consequences of our interference with the traditional course of nature. In particular, after the mighty advances made by the natural sciences, we are more than ever in a position to realize and hence to control also the more remote natural consequences of at least our day-to-day production activities. The more this progresses, the more will we not only feel but also know our oneness with nature, and the more impossible will become the senseless and unnatural idea of a contrast between mind and matter, humanity and nature, soul and body. This regulation, however, requires something more than mere knowledge. It requires a complete revolution in our hitherto existing mode of production, and simultaneously a revolution in our whole contemporary social order. Thanks.
Thanks, Jesse, for that great presentation. We have plenty of time for questions and comments. So I will, if you raise your hand, I'll take a speaker slip.
Okay, I have two questions. One of them, I'm not sure, it might be misunderstood. I think at the beginning when you were talking about like the large corporations and the airlines, you talked about planes and how potentially that form of transportation is subsidized by governments. And I was wondering if you could explain that a bit more and maybe explain what happens in Canada as well, because I have kind of a question about that. And then my second question is about I've heard this in the media, about the whole process of using the military to bring aid, especially to Haiti, and how that was publicized in Canada, that there is policy of it. And so, if that's not the correct response, what would be an alternative to get aid so quickly? Like, what other organizations could be mobilized in such a round of Canada?
Thank you.
we really purchase because I think what's a good example of a multinational corporation is really, when we're talking about capitalism, often costs, you know, you see the same company going on in Mexico, across the world, doing the same thing, and holding up the socialism and companies like that all over the world against the elder and the rich man of the GDP. And, you know, I just think it's such a global point.
It does bring up a question to me, like where to start, the scale of this is so bothering. We're talking about, you know, the planet and the systems, the economic systems that evolve around it. So where to focus that effort and how to do that in Canada particularly, and just wondering if you could comment a bit on ideas there.
I just want to ask a question. How does China fit into all of this with this, you know, this aspect of capitalism? You know, what's their role? And I'm sort of curious about Japan, you know, who it's been quiet in Japan in a sense for some time now because they were quite an economic power for Mother Russia. What, you know, like that picture of Asia and their rise and what that means in terms of this whole picture. Do they have any influence or any, are they continuing the same thing? You know, like, do you have any information on that?
The topic that interests me is, it's sometimes like when it's a very tough political cell to invade a country for military, like for really overt military, like you want to control your economy and you really want to invade people because we really want all your resources to stay free. Natural disasters sort of provide excellent excuses that we've seen in Haiti all over the place. So I wonder if you could flesh out a little bit more of the idea. Like I remember, for example, there was one where Mike Boston was saying that like there was a natural disaster. Who was it? It was a country that had a fairly big human rights issue. They incorporated the responsibility to protect doctrine to say, look, the government's not going to respond adequately. We need to send all these like UN troops in, and like regardless of like, you know, like there's always those risky sovereignty issues when the government really doesn't respond to any of those populists or that kind of corruption happens. But then there's also all the overtones of like imperialist maneuvering when they really want to invade. So I was wondering if you could maybe flesh out a little bit more of the examples of the like the excuse towards like militarism that often comes up with natural disasters.
Natural disasters, as there's a talk focused on, is really compelling because the insurance companies were actually the mechanism inside capitalism. The insurance companies, like, they led the charge on climate change. They were the first ones to kind of like, oh my gosh, we need to start talking about this because they knew that they would not be able to afford to pay out all across. Or climate change, well, the impact of climate change starting to hit. Just, I just want like to hear more about that. So I don't know if you can talk about that at all. Or somebody else in the room, if there's nothing you can speak to, right?
Just a short comment. What's the idea of the insurance companies starting on insurance? Certain private homes and things like that, you can't get insurance against the terrorist attack, for example. You can't get insurance against the bomb strike, which must sound silly, except I remember this was a while ago, it was early 80s in Philadelphia, and the police used bombs in a perfectly ordinary neighborhood to root out an ex-black transport system.
Yeah.
And they ended up bombing an entire city block. And so one thing, and I know this, my own insurance is going to be every X number of years, and every time that I renew, something else gets taken off the property.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought sort of, including acts of God, except if the act of God happens to be, well, similar to a hurricane. Or similar to an earthquake. You don't have to remember something that you really want to, but you do wonder, and that's part of the solution that comes into doing it, for product consumers, is simply standing on the street.
And that will certainly bring up a curious situation with the G20.
Yeah.
You know, like businesses who are staunchly supportive of the current government are now facing the consequences of protesters in the street or people damaging their properties, and they're trying to be able to be insured by the government trying to back. It's like, we're not insured either. So it does bring up a huge issue around the liability and who ends up paying. My guess is somehow the taxpayer, it'll fall back on people to pay for that.
I think it's been very interesting over the past few years, especially I think it was really apparent during the earthquake in Haiti, the overwhelming generosity of people around the world to try and actually do something, anything they could, and a lot of it came in the form of giving donations to various NGOs and organizations working in Haiti, and there's that sense that you want to actually do something to make sure that resources go to help the people, especially when it's in a country that's been so devastated and so utterly poor. And I think it's a really important question to ask, like, what mechanisms are there in place to actually go and deal with it? And, like, the military, we think just naturally, they have force, they have the resources, they have the personnel to go in and, you know, bring aid, bring medical supplies and stuff like that. The trouble is, the mandate of these armies, navies and stuff, is, you know, dictated by their various governments, especially the United States and also Canada, dictated to secure the profits. So Haiti, for example, is basically a sweatshop of the Western, of the Northern governments and corporations. So they're actually fine kind of priorities to go in there to make sure that interest is secure. I mean, and this isn't to say that they don't bring aid, they don't bring tents, blankets, food, and stuff like that, but that's not the primary kind of mandate that they have. And even like from the area organization, the strings that are attached to the aid that they bring, it's almost like kind of have to take a step back and actually look at why are these countries so poor in the first place? And when we saw the government of Aristide elected, who left on a very left platform, actually bringing in very positive reforms, trying to end the direct poverty and stuff like that, and basically almost automatically bombarded with all these strings, having to repay debts, the debt that they had to repay France for overturning the slavery. That France had control of those countries, the massive reparations that they had to pay back to France for basically lost profits that the country would have had. And actually look at the way in which, through imperialism, countries, the rich countries, France, Canada, the United States, have actually implemented, through neoliberal policies, mass privatization, mass deregulation, mass, undermining of any sort of basic social net that countries have, to actually open up them to continue to be sweatshops in the north. So it becomes this really almost complicated when there are such huge forces who actually want to, almost like go there and just do the on-the-ground work, but we don't have any sort of, institution that's able to do that. It kind of blows your mind, especially when you're thinking about the devastating consequences of climate change and how it's just going to kind of continue. So yeah, maybe you can comment on that.
I find that a weird argument about the volcano from the you're talking about the right wing when it basically spews so much CO2 and it's warming up the atmosphere, because volcanoes have a net cooling effect on the atmosphere, whether it's just from the ash reflects the sunlight or the sulfur dioxide also cuts down on the global warming. So if anything, nature's attempt to cool it cooler rather than warmer. But that was just a weird thing stuck in there. I was wondering about how much the problem, this might be a longer snowball, I don't know, but how much are borders in the world a problem as well? Sort of trapping people in areas where there's drought, where there's famine. In Canada, we might be all right with global warming. I know that they're eyeing the Arctic, they're going to go up against the oil, there's supposed to be more places where we can grow crops in Canada, and the government's there's global warming now, we're going to do okay, but if you're in an equatorial country, you're not doing very well. If the glacial runoff is gone because the glaciers are gone, if the rainfall patterns are gone, if you're in somewhere like the West Bank where Israel is diverting the Jordan River and you have no more water, but you're still stuck there because of these international borders. Like, how much of it is a natural disaster, and how much is the politics that you're stuck there because of these international borders, and you don't have the freedom to move away from wherever the problems are, or even within a country if you're one of the poor people in a country and you're forced to live on a hillside, you're forced to live somewhere with poor soil or no water, how much is that a problem?
Thoughtful discussion and the good questions. Jesse, we'll have plenty of time to come back at them. Before we get to him, though, I just wanted to let you know, if you were interested in reading up more about this, Jesse actually has a pamphlet in the bookshop right across the hall called Economic Crisis, War and Resistance. And also along the same lines of this meeting, there's another pamphlet called Hunger in a World of Plenty, What's Behind the Global Food Crisis, another Socialist Worker pamphlet, and lastly by John Bellamy Foster, Marxist Ecology, Materialism and Nature, which also gets into some of what we discussed today. So two last announcements. Anyone from the Oakville, Mississauga area who's attending this Marxism conference is welcome to meet by the sofas near the registration desk at the beginning of the dinner break, I assume tonight, to talk about the ongoing IS work after this conference. And for those of you who are planning to go to the Netanyahu protest tomorrow, the information has altered a bit from the program. Instead, we're meeting tomorrow at 9 a.m., not 9:30, at the northeast corner of Fleet Street and Strand, opposite of Princess Gate. So 9 a.m. tomorrow. And if you want more specific directions, we have them up here. Okay. So, Jesse.
great discussion. Trying to come up on some of those points. I think it's good to start, and as Charlotte did, with the point and the other question as well, that of the huge sort of contrast between what's actually provided and people's intentions. It was similar during the tsunami because the response from the Liberal government was to donate $1 million after a quarter of a million people had died. And within a week, Canadians had donated $50 million. And it was like every day the number went up exponentially. And the Canadian government was having to sort of play catch-up recurrently. And then finally said, okay, fine, we'll give $80 million and it'll be matched and all this sort of stuff. And then there's also contrast in the States because Bush originally first gave $15 million. And again, ordinary Americans, you know, opened up all their pocketbooks and gave huge amounts of money. And then finally he gave $35 million. And then at the time, a Democratic senator said, well, we spent $35 million in Iraq before breakfast. This is just a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the amount of resources. And it is true that, I mean, we have the military. It's, you know, it has unlimited resources. It's been like the Manhattan Project, you know, to say, you know, if our goal is to develop nuclear weapons, you would have the best minds in the world, the most unlimited resources. And it's like, well, why can't we have a Manhattan Project donated and directed towards aid, towards healthcare, towards education, so we actually do have the resources towards that. But it is really difficult to actually go through the paths that have been structured around capitalism because the matching aid that Harper had for Haiti, he was going to give to the World Bank. So he's taking the donations by Canadians and, you know, matching it with Canadian funds by taxpayer dollars, and then that's going to go into a World Bank account, which is supposed to help Haiti. I said, well, you know, we all know what the World Bank does, and that's not very helpful. And then secondly, I mean, when the troops are actually on the ground, I think there's a debate about how much they actually did help. Because, I mean, I know certainly Doctors Without Borders was vocally very frustrated with the American troops because MSF came and had all these medical supplies and was forced to fly around the airport and keep on circling because the U.S. actually controlled the airport and controlled basically the entire island and actually delayed the arrival of aid. So that's one thing. And then secondly, yeah, I mean, you know, why does, as the statement, you know, said, if you shake the earth a little bit, you shouldn't have a disaster. So why is there a disaster in the first place and all the roles that Canada played in actually overthrowing democracy? And also the sort of curious thing is that all the countries scrambling to provide aid have actually been there since 2004. So how is it that they, like, I think it really exposed the nature of the occupation regime, whereas if they actually had been there to promote development, they would have all the structures in place, but this unmasked how they've been there for 60 years and had all the time in the world to establish clinics and all the basic infrastructure, and obviously this is proof that they haven't done that. In terms of China, I think it very much follows a similar pattern. You know, rather than being free market capitalism, it's sort of state capitalism. So it's state operating as corporations do, and its big boom has been fueled by the holding down of people's living conditions and of then driving them off the land, taking advantage of natural resources, concentrating them into the cities. And I think the earthquake there also really unmasked that whole process because you had there's a big, huge economic boom. You think, well, people should be able to live in good houses, good schools, there's all this money, and yet people are forced to build houses out of mud and out of, you know, wood, which is what it was, you know, like going back to mud. I mean, that's what laid the foundation for the earthquake of the 1500s. I mean, surely we must be able to go beyond mud houses in this day and age. So the earthquake there really does, like so many disasters, really unmask what's going on because, and I mean, yeah, similar to borders, I think, you know, with the increase in global warming, there's been more and more cyclones that have smashed usually every few years into Bangladesh, creating millions of displaced people. And then in response, India has been creating all these walls using the same language that the U.S. does, that we have to fight terrorism and protect our borders. But all this is very much, as you said, in order to control borders. I don't know too much about the insurance industry at the moment, but I know that when the earthquake hit, San Francisco, people, the earthquake was partly so devastating because it caused a fire which swept through the city, and people had insurance against the fire, but the earthquake company said, oh no, this was actually caused by the earthquake, so you don't have insurance against this. So again, I mean, it's the same sort of profit, different priorities. And then, if these companies are so great that they exert so much control over the state, then I mean, we've seen if you go to Europe, you can get these, like these companies like Ryanair, you can pay like a pound to fly anywhere in Europe. And then, well, wait, I mean, obviously it costs way more to do that, and there's billions of dollars invested as subsidies to actually make it so cheap and so affordable to actually take a form of transportation which is so destructive to the planet, and which actually does, you know, have a lot of costs which are passed on to other people and to the planet. But if we actually invested that, if we actually had the control to invest that, then we can have rapid rail, green transit. So I think all these disasters, especially in the context of 21st century, when we have, you know, such immense capacities to make the world a better place, it really exposes what's going on. And it's also interesting to see how the economic crisis is actually sharpening this, because, I mean, in Toronto, we're supposed to have Transit City, there's supposed to be $8 billion coming, there's supposed to be tons of trains that are will help the planet, will help people, will help marginalized communities, and yet Dalton McGuinty has cut $4 billion away from that. And also, if you look to Greece as well, the IMF so-called bailout package calls for the scrapping of their entire train system. So again, we see how the economic and the ecologic are increasingly linked, or increasingly going down the drain. But to end on a positive note, I think also around Haiti, people, you know, right away the Facebook group No Shock Doctrines for Haiti got going. Naomi Klein documented how the IMF was going to provide a loan with strings attached, but they were forced to just provide that without strings attached. So people are, I think, starting to see more and more of the contradictions, and it's, you know, it won't be through the channels provided by the system that we'll be able to get to a better place, but through all these movements in solidarity, and I mean, especially the experience in the anti-war movement after Katrina, like that, I think that really sort of showed me how when there's a movement that empowers people beforehand, you know, if it hadn't been for the anti-war movement, there would have been backlash against gays, against blacks. It would have been horrible. But because the movement was there, it had actually trained people in a general outlook about the world, and that the more these movements can grow, the more they can take advantage and use these horrible disasters to expose the system beyond it and to behind it and to fight for a better one.
Thank you.